This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Thank you for joining us at Free Energy Now. You can go to our website, freeenergynow.net, and you can see our call-in numbers. But please hold to the end of the hour before calling in. We have for our guest today Scott Chubb, who is a Princeton graduate. He is with the Naval Research Academy and also an editor for Infinite Energy magazine.
I'm sorry, you have the wrong Scott Chubb. Hold on.
We
I'm
have the wrong Scott.
Sorry.
Now you're pulling my leg.
No, he was wise enough to give his son the same name. I'm sorry. I'll go try and find him. Hold on.
Okay. We called up. We had a Scott Chubb and a Scott Chubb's son who also has the same name. So while we're waiting for Scott Chubb, the real Scott Chubb for this show, to come online, Scott has been doing cold fusion research for a good long time. He was actually doing it in association with an aspect of the Naval Research Academy for 10 years and has a very in-depth knowledge of the field from personal experience, under government funding type of thing, and has also published around 60 refereed publications on that and other subjects. And so where cold fusion has typically received a very negative reaction from the academic community, there are exceptions to that pariah type of approach, and Scott Chubb's experience happens to have been one of those. Are you with us now?
No, he's asleep. I'm very sorry.
Okay. We have a live show going on right now. He was scheduled to be with us for an hour.
Did he know about this earlier?
Yeah, we've been talking about it.
Oh, God.
So if you could get him.
I'll try to wake him up.
Okay. Well, I have a hard time letting that one down. Scott Chubb is waking up right now. It's 6 o'clock p.m. in Washington, D.C., where he's at. I met Scott at the Conference on Future Energy in D.C. last month. Let's see, we're November, I guess 2 months ago, September. He's an outstanding individual. It was really a pleasure to get to know him. And he actually plans on joining us in the New Energy Congress. He was very supportive of what he saw us trying to accomplish there and looking at various energy technologies and ranking them according to their green, clean, affordable, reliable, credible, et cetera, that they are. We have 10 criteria that we judge different technologies according to and right down his alley of what he likes to do. As an editor for the New Energy or Infinite Energy magazine, which is actually carrying forth the work of the late Eugene Malouf, who was murdered a couple of years ago under unusual circumstances. Anyway, he's been carrying on the work there, and that magazine covers a lot of different energy topics, including cold fusion. Scott Chubb was actually the opening editorial in a recent article in New Energy Times, or new recent edition that came out yesterday. There was a feature article by him and Bear. Scott, are you with us now?
Yes.
Okay. I had a little bit a mix up there. We got going with your son, and he was saying, is this some kind of a practical joke? And then turns out Dad's off taking a nap. Oh, my gosh.
That's fine. I'm here.
Okay, so we are now, we are live right now.
Cool.
I'm guessing we don't have too many people listening to us live because we weren't able to get the news out about this until fairly late. And so we're not probably going to be bothered by too many attempts for call-ins, which is nice that we can get a good overview of the field. And if somebody does want to call in, I'd like to encourage them to do that toward the end of the hour.
Sure.
I've given you an introduction, and hopefully it's been fairly accurate. You've not been there to be able to correct anything, so hopefully the information we have on the site that you did review is accurate.
Yes, I did.
So we should be fine there. We wanted to talk about three different areas, basically. The history of cold fusion, one particular recent development in cold fusion that has high credibility in terms of kind of breathing some good air into the technology, give it more acceptance among the academia. Mm-hmm. And then the third question, major question or area of discussion will be talking about where cold fusion is going to be in the future in terms of products that might show up in the marketplace for us to buy that are using cold fusion. So let's start with the history. When did you get involved in cold fusion?
I got involved at the beginning. I got involved in 1989 when it started.
Mm-hmm. And you were with, were you at the NRL then?
Yes. Yes, I was.
And what? Is that when the National or Naval Research Academy started sponsoring some cold fusion research?
Right. Yes. It was. It was. What happened was that things were, were happening, and Naval Research Laboratory got involved in the beginning because it was something neat that was going on. Pons and Fleshman were being funded there, being funded by a guy named Robert Nowak, and it happened. That's basically how it started, and it didn't leave. It never stopped. So it went on.
Well, it went on. That there's no doubt about that. But obviously, the field has been given a very negative view by mainstream academia, because apparently it was difficult to replicate those initial effects that we're seeing.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was difficult to replicate it, but, it wasn't, actually. It was viewed as being difficult to replicate. It was replicated in many different places. What happened was that there was a rush to judgment about it. It was that's what happened. It was replicated in many different places. The difficulty was, when it really comes down to it, is
why then did it get such a negative slant on it? Because
when you say
the word cold fusion, and people are rolling their eyes.
Well, there was a lot of confusion. It began with a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion, and a lot of people sort of said, this is nothing, this is like garbage. And Lothary was garbage. It really wasn't. That was the beginning, that was the start.
Do you think part of the reason for that was because some people were having a hard time replicating the effect and were reporting it as being a dud?
And absolutely, yeah, sure.
So because it wasn't an unequivocal, step A, step B, step C, and you get your results, it was perceived as being not fraudulent, but hokey.
Right, absolutely, yeah, sure.
Do you think also there's an aspect to, there was a lot of spin put on it in terms of, you think cold fusion and the ideas that you're harnessing, the types of energies you have in the sun, and, people are having high expectations that this thing is going to solve our energy needs very soon, and maybe it's taken a lot longer to get to that point than what people would expect. And that maybe has contributed also to its reputation. Do you think how much of a fact do you think that is?
Absolutely, yes, that's correct. Sure, correct, yeah.
Because even today, here we are, 17 years later, And it's still true that if you say the word cold fusion in academic circles, you know, you're looked with a jaundiced eye. It's not looked at as a credible field of science. You can't use the word cold fusion with a straight face, and people think that you're normal.
Right. Yeah. The term we've adopted is called condensed matter nuclear science. Yes. Right. Yeah. The basic problem has been the breakdown in communication. Yes. Everything you say is right. It was unexpected when it happened, and it's, you know, very confused now. But it is quite real. The effect is quite real.
One thing I've seen is there are a lot of referee type of papers that are published on the effect. There are academic type of gatherings, several each year worldwide. Most often there are annual gatherings about cold fusion. These are scientists who are meeting together and sharing their papers just as in any other scientific gathering. Do you have a feel for how many people have A, replicated the effect, and B, how many papers have been published in referee journals that the academia would say are bona fide?
Yes. The problem has been referee journals and, yes. I mean, the basic question is how significant is this question? What has been refereed and so forth and so on? It broke down very early. There were many, many credible things that were said at the beginning. And it deteriorated rapidly. And I was like, okay. So, well, what was it that you were asking about? It's like...
Well, the first question was, how many people, do you have a feel for how many people worldwide since 1989 when it first was announced, how many people have been successful in replicating the effect?
Oh, yes. Well, there have been about hundreds, thousands, close to thousands. So it's hundreds of thousands have replicated what's been going on. And I think the important point is that there really has been organized research in this area. The Naval Research Laboratory, the Office of Naval Research, has been involved in a deep way in terms of doing this. And they have done this. They have organized things. It does, it is quite real. It is a real thing that's been going on. You know, and it's like, okay, as opposed to sort of saying, well, this is like nothing. What happened was, on May 1, 1989, the American Physical Society presented a mayhem kind of exercise and confusion. They had a session, and at that session they said that there was nothing going on. And it was totally stupid. Since then, things have happened. There was, through the Office of Naval Research, something that was quite real. And the group involved the Naval Research Laboratory and involved Space Warfare Systems Center, San Diego, and it involved the Naval Air Warfare Center. And these three groups did do something that demonstrated the effect was quite real. And it went on. People involved sincerely looked at what had happened, and it was quite real, and it is real. And it was very different from anything that people thought. There was this basic idea that it had to be that if cold fusion, in quotes, had to occur based upon how people thought what was thought of as cold fusion. But it wasn't that. It was something much more basic. It was a new effect that was discovered. New effect involved creating energy, but it wasn't, in quotes, a colder version of conventional fusion. What had been discovered was something entirely different. It was a new form of fusion. And that was part of the problem. It was something so different that people didn't get it. What was discovered was something that involved electromagnetism in a way that was totally unexpected. So, what are you saying? Well, what happened? It's different. And that was part of the problem. You know? So, I guess you have to ask, what happened, actually? Well, there was a breakdown. There was confusion about what happened. And it's still getting sorted out, but it's really pretty great. It's really pretty amazing. As opposed to cold fusion, it is something that is now called condensed nuclear science. It's called low-energy nuclear reactions. It's just beyond what anybody might think. Does that help?
Yeah. Maybe you could just take a minute and describe... maybe on behalf of those who are not familiar with the process, just give us a brief overview of what is happening.
Okay. Well, normally in conventional fusion, you have a proton and a neutron. That's called a deuteron. And you have a proton and a neutron. That's another deuteron. They come together. So there are two particles. A proton, a neutron, a proton, and a neutron. And when they come together normally, at, in quotes, high momentum, they break apart, hit one another. So you get two protons and a neutron, or two neutrons and a proton. They don't stand together as a pair. They break apart. And you can put it in your fingers. You have two particles coming in. You have a proton and a neutron, proton and neutron. And they sort of split apart. You get two protons and a neutron, and two neutrons and a proton. And something flies off. That's conventional fusion. And conventional fusion... when you have two neutrons and a proton, and then a proton coming off, that's called hydrogen 3. Two neutrons and a proton coming off, and a proton coming off, that's hydrogen 3. It's also called tritium, and then you get a proton coming off. The other reaction is, in a similar vein, is two protons and a neutron, which is helium 3, and you get a neutron going off. That's what you normally see. These reactions don't pay attention to electromagnetism. And that's been the interesting aspect of this. They're basically stupid reactions. And it's what happens most of the time. I say stupid because they don't pay attention to the details associated with electromagnetism. Electromagnetism can really change this. And there's nothing that says that that can't happen. It's simply that when it's stupid, that is when it's, I'd say, at high momentum, dumb. And when electromagnetism can be involved, it doesn't have to be that way. That's the basic thing. And in solids, electromagnetism can make a difference. And electromagnetism can be profoundly different. And that's the basic problem. Electromagnetism has been ignored in this. Now, it is true that there is another reaction where two protons and one proton, one neutron, and one neutron and one proton do combine. It can happen. It does happen. And they do come together, and they do create something. It's not split. They do create two protons and two neutrons, which is called helium-4. And it does occur. And why it occurs involves details about electromagnetism. And that's what's missing. They haven't been talking about that, and that's at the heart of the confusion. Yes, it's perfectly allowable. Not only allowable, it does happen. The difficulty is that details about this have not been part of the discussion.
So, when the Department of Energy reviewed fusion, cold fusion, a year and a half ago or so.
Right, it was in 1994, yes.
And they gave it somewhat of a thumbs sideways. It wasn't really a thumbs down, and it wasn't a thumbs up.
Right.
They said, yeah, there's something going on there, but it doesn't look to be anything worthwhile. Why was it such a ambivalent response? Why, since, you know, the naval, there are government departments, including the one that you're involved in, that have actually been involved with successful replications and theories about what's going on. Why were those voices heard?
I think so. I think very much of the problem has been that, yes, I think it was heard. I think that things are happening. I think that there was so much negative stuff initially, but it is happening, yes. So my view about it is that, yes, things are going in the positive way. But, you know, it's like, it was a very difficult time, you know, and it has changed, it's been changing. And part of it is exchanges like this. It's like there was a lot of confusion. But it's changing.
Okay, so let's get into what happened at a recent conference in D.C. You said it was August, that there was a
July, right? The you're talking about the National Defense Industrial Association,
right? The one that the magazine recently called extraordinary proof or something like that.
Right.
What was that about?
Well, what was really novel? There was Science magazine had a very wonderful article covering what had been going on through the Office of Naval Research. The Office of Naval Research, that's ONR, it's the parent organization of where I work, had done something from 1991 to 2001. That did involve officially sponsored work involving the Naval Research Laboratory, the Space Warfare Systems Center in San Diego, and the Naval Air Warfare Center, and the Space Warfare Center San Diego showed something. They've continued. They went beyond the work that was actually officially sanctioned through the Office of Naval Research. And they showed something that was really amazing. What they showed was that it really was possible to create radioactivity in a cold fusion experiment, which was, that was one of the things that was really tough. What had happened in the earlier effort was that it was possible to demonstrate the existence of excess heat, heat that could not be explained by normal chemical processes, and that really could be tied to a nuclear reaction, but it was very difficult to track down the origin of the nuclear reaction. And they showed that by changing the environment of what might be viewed as a nuclear reaction, you could actually get high-energy particles And it was amazing. It's an amazing result. You know, it's like, it's in most situations, it's pretty obvious if you see something that's nuclear in process. But this is such a subtle effect that it was very difficult to say that there was anything nuclear going on. He showed it. And that was incredible. And that's what they showed at this meeting. And what they did was to change the things, and the first thing to recognize is that most people were not paying attention to what they'd been doing. All along, the people from the Space Warfare Systems Center at San Diego, that's SWC, Space Warfare Systems Center, SWSCSD, that's Space Warfare Systems Center San Diego, SWSCSD. They were able to create cold fusion on demand. That is the excess heat effect. And finally, they were able to do it and to create a nuclear reaction. That's the neat thing. They created the reaction on demand. You know, it's like, well, once, you know, it's like, and, you know, it goes beyond that. It's like, not only did they create the effect on demand, which was something that bothered people that it could possibly be true, but they also want to step beyond. By changing the environment of what they were looking at, they could create high energy particles and an image. You know, it's like Becquerel, when he created radioactivity, Becquerel was the finder of radioactivity. He was the one who discovered that there is something called radioactivity. When he did it, he created an image. These people have also created an image. And it's like, see that? No, it's real.
No, so, it's like taking a picture or like...
Yes, they created an image. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. They did. Yes, they did.
And this hadn't been done before?
No. No, absolutely not. No. Right, yes.
Now, is this a variant of the cold fusion phenomena, or is
it's not really a variant. What happened was that, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a variant. What I'm saying is that it's a much more interesting kind of way of producing effects that creates a variant. It's there, but it was subtle, and people didn't understand what was going on. That's the way I would view it. You know, I was like, so, was it something? No, it wasn't really something new. It was there all along, but it's coming out now. You know?
Well, let's explore for a second this topic of variance. And there are a lot of people who are chasing this effect of the cold fusion and are looking at what's going on there and are trying to, get the effect themselves. Are they all using this? I mean, obviously, there can be different approaches to the same type of thing. Look at how many different engines there are that burn fuel. There are gazillions of approaches of how to burn fuel, how to do it efficiently. There are some that are fairly standard, but there's a lot of variance in internal combustion engine field.
Yes.
Is there that same kind of variety in cold fusion research?
Yes, absolutely. There's been a lot of, yes. That's been part of the source of confusion. Yes, sure. I agree.
And yet in the internal combustion engine, one thing that is in common is you have the explosion of a gas and you have the harnessing of that through the creation of torque.
Right.
And that's what they all have in common. What would you say is a common denominator of all cold fusion research?
Well, there's been deuterium in a metal, and people don't understand what is in common. They have recognized as heat in the most compelling experiments. They've recognized as heat, and there are effects that go along with the heat. The really neat thing about this stuff and the Spa War experiments is that the heat has been turned into high energy particles. And that's very compelling. Once you start seeing high energy particles, and you can turn them on demand, the question of whether it's nuclear ends. You know, it's like, it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basic. Now, there have been lots of things that have happened. And that gets a lot, in terms of a lot of interesting physics. Part of the problem is that there's been a mindset that you couldn't get interesting physics out of this. Well, of course you can. And it has happened. And so you ask, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, it's really an incredibly interesting subject.
Mm-hmm. Let's hold that thought for a second. We are at the bottom of the hour, and Vin has called in for her weekly presentation on
sure.
how to reduce our energy footprint on the planet. Zen, you go ahead.
Sure.
Hi, Sterling. Greetings. Today I will address the air pollution. Half of all Americans live in counties where air pollution exceeds natural health standards, and the Clean Air Act is not working. Clear Sky Act is not working. We need the Clean Air Act. Congress should protect public health and environment by rewriting the rules to establish mandatory limits on power plant smokestack emissions and enforcing a new Clean Air Act. Reports conclude that U.S. global warming pollutants failure to limit emissions from burning coal, oil, natural gas has allowed warming pollutions to grow out of control. EPA proposed new limits on particle pollution and clean up coal-fired power plants, which are the biggest industrial pollutants causing asthma, heart attacks, and other respiratory problems. The American Lung Association are fighting changes in Congress to keep the ability to fight air pollution strong. You can help by supporting the American Lung Association in their fight. This is a contact number, 1-800-LUNG-USA. That's LUNG-USA. So you can be involved in your area. And you can also log on at www.lungusa.org. So we must reduce our dependence on fossil fuels by making our homes, the businesses, autos, and of course the power plants more energy efficient from renewable sources. The longer we wait to reduce global warming pollutants, the harder the task will be in the future to avoid climate change. NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies stated that the Earth's climate is nearing a tipping point, and the consequences are sea level rises, heat waves, drought, intense hurricanes, floods, decreased crop yield, good water scarcity, and spread of diseases. And here's some reports of EPA's data on what the power plant's emissions are. Everybody hears of ozone. It's the country's most pervasive air pollutant. And it's the primary component of smog. 22% of pollutants is smog forming nitrogen oxides. Particle pollution is what makes soot. 67% of soot forming sulfur dioxide is the most deadliest. And power plants emitted over 90,000 pounds of mercury in a 2003 report into the air, which goes into the air onto the land and waterways. And in 44 states, the FDA is warning people to limit their consumption of fish. Locomotive and marine diesel engines are a major source of air pollution. So here's a few tips on how to protect yourself and limit your risk of danger to your health and the air. One thing is not to burn wood or trash when you can. Use electric lawn care equipment instead of gas fuel. And alternative travel like subways, buses, and so on when possible. And you can ride a bike or walk when you can. Replace air filters in the home, business, and car regularly and ventilate with good exhaust fans. And tell the children not to stand too near the school bus diesel exhaust while the bus is running. There's a website website to check out for many more hints like this. It's called 1,000 Friends of Fresno. That's www.1000friendsoffresno, FRESNO.org. So thank you and blessings.
Thank you, Zinya. Okay, Scott, we have, just back to talk to the audience for a second, we do have on our show today Scott Chubb, who is presently with the Naval Research Academy.
Naval Research Laboratory.
Oh, laboratory, I'm sorry. And have been since 1989, which is when the cold fusion research started. And you've been talking about how interesting this cold fusion research is and the variety. Maybe you could talk for a second about the applicability of this science.
First of all, I would love to chime in with what was her name? Your speaker?
Zinya?
Right. She's absolutely right about, being forefront, about taking charge with regard to science. The science is moving on. Russ George, in particular, is somebody who people should pay attention to. He's a real visionary. Russ George has founded a company called D2 Fusion.
It's a subsidiary
of a holding company called Solar Energy Limited. And that's great. That's where you can actually purchase stock through his company. It's a great company. D2 Fusion. And it's real vision, and it will go far. He's also involved in the context of the greater things associated with global warming. He's involved with a second company called Planktos Incorporated. Planktos is involved with the effort to actually really a very novel and important company associated with potentially really helping the planet.
Don't they go out and actually drop iron into areas of plankton depletion? Plankton depletion. And it gets the plankton replenished, which is the bottom of the food chain, to replenish some of these suffering areas where they're like 85% down.
Yes, you're hitting the nail on the head. What plankton is involved with is invigorating the oceans. It's a neat idea, an important idea. The oceans are becoming now source of CO2 as opposed to something that absorbs CO2. That's tough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the way things should be. The oceans should be absorbing CO2. And what we're talking about here is a basic idea that what we breathe out, plants are supposed to breathe in. It's not happening here now. And it is related to global warming. The oceans are supposed to breathe in what we breathe out, but it's not been happening because in order for the oceans to breathe in what we breathe out, they're supposed to get an appropriate number of nutrients. And they get it through dust. They're supposed to get it through dust. And it's been happening historically that they get it through dust. But the dust simply isn't there. And it's not there because it's not as much dust because deserts have been driving. They've been drying. The deserts have been becoming more green. And it's remarkable, quite frankly, that somebody would identify this. But Russ George has identified this. The deserts have not been creating enough dust because they're getting greener, and the oceans have been drying, have been not getting enough dust. So they've been the oceans have been getting wetter, and so they don't get enough. And it's basic, plants need iron, and the ocean involves plants that need iron. They need dust. They need the nutrients. They're not getting it. And that's an amazing observation. It's like the basic point about we breathe out what plants breathe out what we breathe in. There's a rhythm there. Think about it. We breathe out what plants breathe out what we breathe in. The interesting niche is that plants aren't able to breathe out stuff unless we allow it to happen. And what's novel is that dust, basic dust, can make this happen. What we might think might make it hard to breathe out and breathe in can actually create paths for it. The deserts can do it. And it's just, it's basic ecology kind of question.
And so this same Russ George, who is involved in planting the oceans with the necessary nutrients to reinvigorate the life in the oceans, is also heavily involved in cold fusion research. And from what I understand, he actually has a technology, and he hopes to introduce to the marketplace next year a cold fusion heater. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if the heater's there, but he certainly has the vision to try to make the heater work, yes.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, Russ George, in my opinion, is a visionary. Yes, absolutely. I mean, as soon as I get enough money, I'm going to invest a lot in his companies. And I'm saying that quite candidly. Yes. Russ
now,
is a real innovator. He's great.
When we talk about cold fusion, we think nuclear, and you're talking about these high-energy particles in this show. Why would people want a nuclear reactor to heat their home?
Well, first of all, I would not say that there are high-energy particles involved at all. What's involved here is low-energy nuclear reactions, and it goes hand-in-hand with the sort of unexpected. It's like, yeah, it's sort of like, why would anybody think that putting small amounts of iron into the ocean could solve global warming? That's totally beyond the radar screen for most people. Certainly, no. You know, it's like, there's no high-energy particles, and there's nothing. There's no radioactivity involved with any of this. It's like, it's different. And it's all at once tremendous and all at once unexpected is what I would say. So, I don't know if what I said was a, you know, sort of a point of confusion or reality or what, but that's what it is. It's like,
well,
I prefer to call it conventional nuclear science.
This recent study that has been done has been called extraordinary evidence. You were saying that what was unusual about what they did is they were able to produce cold fusion on demand, and that they were creating radioactivity, and they were able to create an image to demonstrate that they had achieved those high energy particles. So that is not always happening in productive cold fusion reactions. You don't have those high energy particles, which
can
be meant to help.
Yeah. What they did was, I mean, I think at the heart of a lot of what has been seen is it involves electromagnetism in ways that people simply have not understood it. If you go back to what happened in 1897 with Becquerel, who was the one who discovered radioactivity. In the end, his experiments involved images, and they involved electromagnetism. And it was really amazing. What Becquerel did was to create an image. It was very, very peculiar. Becquerel initially was looking at a phenomenon called phosphorescence. It was phosphorescence involves seeing something after the fact that's stimulated by light. The peculiar thing that Becquerel encountered was it was not actually created by light. He tried to make light do it. In the things involving phosphorescence, what you do is you try to stimulate something involving light. So he started with the precursors of television tube. Crookes tube is what it's called. And he gradually realized the Crookes tube had nothing to do with it. But now, by accident, what he did was he looked at something. It was a uranium salt. He looked at something that now we know creates radioactivity. And at this point, they didn't know what radioactivity was. Now, what's neat is that the same thing, creating an image through something we didn't understand, is a really neat way of seeing there is something going on.
Mm-hmm.
In Becquerel's case, what happened was that he had this thing that was supposed to be stimulated by light. And first he put it in front of this TV tube, and he saw something. Then he took it out, and he had light put up, you know, sort of stimulate things. But when he did it, he tried to block the light, and he did. And he saw something still. And then he, just because it was a rainy day in March of 1897, he blocked it, and then there was something there. And that's what the people from the Space Warfare Systems Center at San Diego saw. They blocked things, and there was an image.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, people couldn't believe it. They didn't believe it for 16 years. And then they finally said, well, holy mackerel, there is. There's something there. And then it got better and better. An interesting point is that what they did was what they did to create the image was to actually make it possible to understand how you could create the image. They introduced things that made it happen. They introduced magnetic and electrical fields, and then suddenly it was there. And it's beautiful. So, you know, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. Yes, it is. When you can create an image of something.
With that image being created, now that we have the, you know, photographs, so to speak, how long do you think it's going to take for the negative momentum to stop of, you know, the jaundiced look at cold fusion? Because obviously this is very compelling evidence, and yet, you know, I'm guessing that the entrenchment of the negative stigma of cold fusion will take years still.
I don't think years. I think, you know, Pamela Moser Boss is going to present this at the American Physical Society meeting in March.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like she presented it in July. And enough people see it, enough knowledgeable people see it, it'll happen. It's going to happen. The difficulty has been that there was a negative stigma, but it's over now, I think. I think it's going to happen, you know. It's just getting people to realize that it's real. And they will.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the difficulty was getting the sort of, you might call it the signal-to-noise problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a noise problem or signal-to-noise problem. This is obvious. When you start seeing high-energy particles, and then you start seeing neutrons and gamma rays, okay, the physicists finally come on board. You know, it's like they're not used to this. It's the chemists discovered something, and it's hard to accept it for mainstream physicists, but that's where we are right now, I think.
Okay. So let's go back to our previous question about applications of this technology, where, you know, you're going to be putting devices in your home that are cold fusion powered, and we're talking about the evidence for cold fusion being radioactive evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And why do we want radioactive emitting devices in our home?
So what's the question?
The question is this technology that Russ George is proposing to implement into an actual heater for a home, does it involve some kind of a nuclear effect, or is that able to be blocked adequately through any...
Well, it's a nuclear effect, but it's fine. That was part of the problem. People accepting it. not dangerous. There's nothing to it.
So even in these experiments that are being promoted, that you were just talking about, the presentation to the American Physical Society coming up in March, that data, that information, it involves radioactivity, but it's not health-impairing radioactivity?
No, of course not. Yes. That's been part of a source of confusion, yes. No, there's nothing bad about it. It's great. What we're talking about is a reaction that's 10 million times better than a burning rocket fuel. And there's nothing bad about it. The only thing that it creates is the most inert element known to man at low energy. It's helium-4.
Mm-hmm.
And what that translates to is it's extraordinary. I mean, the reaction can... I mean, 10 million is a large number. And there's every reason to believe that in a way that's similar to the way that transistors could conduct electricity in such a way that they could create, you know, useful devices, that in, quote, cold fusion or condensed matter nuclear science environments, the environment can automatically take charge of things in such a way that it will take the component, without much engineering, it will take the component, which is one part in 5 to 6,000 of water. So you have normal water, about one part in 6,000 of it. It's heavy water. And it will simply take it out and allow for a reaction that's 10 million times more effective than anything we know, and take out 6,000 of it, 1/6,000. And just to put things in perspective, suppose it's 1 part in 5,000, which is a little over approximation. But if you take 10 million and you divide it by 5,000, you still have 2,000. And so the reaction, and it's like, will be made by the material. So you take 1 part in 5,000 of 10 million, which is 2,000. 2,000 says it's 2,000 better than any kind of normal chemical reaction that we know. Now, it's not hard to envision taking normal rocket fuel and going 30 miles to a gallon of normal rocket fuel in any kind of, you know, sort of normal car. Now, suppose you have 2,000 times that in any kind of, you know, vehicle, and you do it by cold fusion. 2,000 times 30 miles to a gallon is 60,000 miles to a gallon, and with no pollution. So that's what we're talking about. And that's a conservative estimate.
Now, how much are those devices going to cost? Are they going to be highly expensive, or when is it going to be feasible?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And that depends upon how people respond to that. It's obviously a terribly disruptive technology. You know, it's when, I mean, at the heart of this gets down to when people are going to, first of all, accept that there's a reality of it, and how they're going to respond to that reality. No, it's like what you're doing right now is part of opening the dialogue about that. It's incredible. It really is. It's tragic also. It's tragic that people haven't been paying attention to this, but it will happen. And it's, you know, it's an eye-opener. It's like, I don't know. Like you say, well, when will it? I don't know.
Well, Scott, it's been a pleasure talking to you about this. We're out of time here. It's been an interesting session on cold fusion and its history and where
condensed
we're at.
Condensed matter nuclear science, the program.
That's part of getting out of the stigma, is using a more scientific phraseology, eh?
Well, it's great that you're doing this. It really is, you know. It's great that, Sterling, that you're asking these questions and going beyond a conventional thing. You know, it's like, it's amazing. So an amazing situation. And it's like,
well, that's what we do. Do you have any kind of web presence, Scott?
No, not really. I mean, I'm associated with Infinite Energy, and yeah, I should get a website. I don't have one.
Yeah, you should.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And for the listeners, you can join us each day at freeenergynews.com to hear our latest happenings in the world of free energy, including what's going on with cold fusion. You can join us each week at freeenergynow.net. Thanks for being on today.
Freeenergynow.net. Now?
And freeenergynews.com is our daily offering.
Okay. Well, you take care.
All right, you too.
All right, bye.
Bye.